This podcast is brought to you by Aldis International, supplying your expert AI and digital transformation staffing needs across the U.S. and Europe. Today, you are listening to our AI in Action series, where leading minds in AI from across the world share their story, success, and advice. AI in Action cuts through the hype and explores the true impact of artificial intelligence in our world today.
You're listening to AI in Action. I'm your host, JP Valentine. Our guest today is Mark Brady. Mark is the Deputy Chief Data Officer for TRMC at KBR. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you, JP. Good to be here.
Yeah, we're delighted to have you. I was very excited about this one, just given your incredibly interesting background. So let's start there. Let's jump straight into it. Mark, can you tell us a little bit about your background in data and technology, from where you got started, what drew you to it, some of the roles you've held along the way, and what's led you to where you are today as a Deputy Chief Data Officer for KBR?
Yeah, well, I didn't really start out looking to get into data management, data science. Actually, started out being interested in scientific research and development in industry. And in that regard, I worked for Kodak back when that was a thing, worked for the automotive industry, work for 3M doing research and development in areas like medical devices, traffic management, AI, things like that. And my work in AI got me more and more interested in progress in that area. And it was, things were plateauing to a certain extent. And so I thought AI goes back and forth between a biomimetic approach and engineering approach. I'm going to look at biomimetic and see if I can get some new ideas. So I went and I got a PhD in neuroscience, started to do neuroscience research and also teaching statistics as well. At some point, though, I decided that academia really was focused more on grant getting than research and teaching. So I thought, let's cut out the middleman and just go to work directly for the government because they're the ones that are funding us anyway. So became an analyst statistician for National Marine Fisheries Service. And that's where I really got started in data specifically. I would recommend anybody getting into the field to get some experience as an analyst, because from that perspective, you see the data systems, what works in those data systems, what doesn't work in those data systems. And then you also have the viewpoint of the users. How do you best serve the users? And really, that's what data science is all about. So I started doing that sort of thing, re-engineering the data systems, even though it wasn't my job. And as a result of that work and some of the work that I did in analytics, was promoted to the position of information architect for all of National Marine Fisheries, and then set up their program, made them number one among the different components of NOAA, of which it's a part, and also helped NOAA to develop their data program. And then some of the leaders in NOAA at that time were moving over to the Department of Justice, the CIO and the CTO, and they invited me to come over there and rinse and repeat. And then when I saw the opportunity to work as a chief data officer for Air Force Space Command, I jumped at that. And then when the Space Force was set up, then I transitioned over to be CDO of the Space Force. So that's basically how I got into it, and seems like 90% common sense to me. So it's fairly easy and confusing to a lot of other people. So it's a good fit.
Thank you for that, Mark. I want to spend more time talking about your transition and journey, because you identified following some interests and then seeking out opportunities, which led to some incredible roles. Chief Data Officer for Air Force Space Command, and then the Chief Data Officer for U.S. Space Force are some fairly lofty titles. But you've since moved on and you find yourself now at KBR. Tell us all about KBR for people listening who are not familiar with the business, who you are, what you do, mission of the organization.
KBR provides technical expertise in a couple of areas primarily. One is for the government, and then the other is in the energy industry.
Now, for reasons of NDAs and such, a lot of the work you do is not for public ears, unfortunately, albeit very interesting. So we'll keep things at a surface level. But I want to use this conversation as an opportunity to get some insight in your take on the current landscape of data science, AI, how it's changed from your time entering into the field. So let's start with the current landscape of AI. What are, as a chief data officer and a role that you've held now for a number of years, when you're speaking to your counterparts, your peers, your team, what are some of the hot topics that you're focusing on right now and more importantly, helping your customers stay on top of the latest and greatest things within the world of AI? Because it's become a broad brushstroke. It's somewhat lost its meaning. So defining what AI is can be difficult in and of itself. But where do you find yourself spending your time? What's most interesting to you at the moment?
Well, the thing that has struck me the most is the maturity level of data science and data management throughout the technical community. And it's really quite immature. So if I were to make a comparison with alchemy and chemistry back in those days when chemistry was first coming on, most organizations are at the alchemy stage right now. They're practicing what I would call first generation data management. And a lot of those practices are really not the best practices. And so a lot of effort can go into that. And you might ask, is this really driving my mission success? And often the answer is no, it isn't. What you really need is what I call next generation data management. And that's the whole reason I came up with that concept and paradigm for doing things.
So Mark, using that analogy of alchemy to chemistry and beyond, when you look at the next iterations of effective data science, use of data management, what are the things that you're talking about to put in the spotlight so that both from a KPR standpoint, you and your team are focused on doing best practice? And how does that translate into helping your customers, whether it be public sector government work or some private sector customers?
It's important to think of your data management as being a pipeline. And the end of that pipeline is the analysis. And in many cases, we think of analytics as being the whole of data management, but it really isn't. There's a whole lot that goes on upstream of that. And the old expression is garbage in, garbage out, right? So you want to have high quality data. You want to have data which really enables your analytics and makes it more powerful, because you can take the same set of data sets and you can, and even if both of them are very accurate, which isn't always the case, you will find that some of them allow more powerful analytics than others, depending on the way that they're structured. You need to make your data discoverable. There are organizations that have thousands of different data sets. So if you were to ask any one person, tell me whether or not the organization has data on such and such and name all those databases, it's not as easy as it sounds. Then there's the understanding of data. What exactly does your data mean? Say you have a date in a file. Is that the date of what? What time zone was it? So forth. Good analysts have a lot of questions about what data means. Data discovery and data understanding, those are both managed using metadata. So metadata management is a big part of data management. Then there's system design along with database design. The way you design your databases and your data systems is very important as well, both in terms of their capabilities and also what it costs you to run them. So what happens in many organizations is you have data systems which evolve historically. You have one data system and then you add another data system and then you realize, okay, these need to be attached to each other in a certain way. And the next thing you know, you have a lot of connections and data flowing around and you lose track of even what that architecture is as opposed to designing it. So these are some of the main things that make up next generation.
So Mark, you mentioned earlier that the state of data management in its current form and how it needs to progress. You're involved in that progression yourself. So Could you share a little bit of information about the work that you've been doing regarding training and development courses and how that connects back to the book which you've authored so that our audience can get exposure to it themselves, either via the book itself or the course or maybe a combination of both?
I don't want to leave people hanging and just say you got to go and do Next Generation without explaining, but where are you going to go for that? So based on the work that I did at NOAA and Department of Justice and later with the Space Force and training over 100 data scientists at Space Force, I decided that we need to really write down all of this experience and where we need to go next. And so contributed to the community a book called Next Generation Data Management, and then was contacted by Udacity more recently. They were looking for a course along those lines. And so we've developed the first lesson in a course on next generation data management.
One of the things you and I were speaking about previously off recording was the topic of safe AI, because as we talk about next generation AI and data, I know a hot topic right now is the concerns around safety, especially when it comes to public sector security, use of data in government organizations. And this is something you're obviously very well versed in. So when you're speaking to your peers, when you're looking at the topic of safety within AI, what are some of the fundamentals that you're focused on? What should we look for from a positive note? What are the risks that we need to be aware of? And where do you see this evolving over the coming years?
As you're probably aware, there's luminaries out there like Hawking and Musk who have been warning us about some of the dangers of AI as it becomes very powerful. And I don't think we're quite there yet in terms of it being so powerful that there are dangers, but that is coming on very quickly. And so I think we need to, instead of taking a broad brush and saying it's going to be some kind of an apocalypse like in the Terminator, or alternatively, you might hear a TED talk where someone says that the future will be a nirvana because of AI. It's really more nuanced than that. And the question we have to ask is, how do you make AI safe once it starts to become very powerful? And interestingly, this question goes back to 1942 with Asimov, came up with his three laws of robotics. And this was amazing because at that point, there didn't even exist a programmable electronic computer that came out in 1945. So in his writings, he's got this three laws of robotics because back at that time, the term AI didn't exist yet. That came in the 50s. But anyway, he was concerned with the safety of robotics / AI. And he was introducing what I would call today in a modernized version, AI safety objective functions. Human beings have emotion, which are the things which motivate us to do what we do. And AI has something called an objective function, possibly multiple objective functions. And these are the things that motivate AI to do what it does. So it isn't really the power of AI that might make it safe or might make it dangerous. It's what is the thing trying to do. For that purpose, I introduced what I call the six laws of safe AI. And the first few deal with this safety objective function. First of all, you have to have one. And secondly, it has to override all of the other objective functions that might be in that particular AI. And it has to be immutable, because if it changes, then that might defeat the whole purpose of having this safety objective function. And then the third and fourth laws deal with artificial evolution. So as AIs start building other AIs, which they will, we already have auto-generated code, right? So we're on the way to this sort of thing. So you have this artificial evolution, which is going to start happening. So you need safety laws to address that. Number one is any parent AI has to pass on to its children its objective functions, its safety objective functions. And secondly, objective functions can't have maximization of numbers or resources included in them, because if they do, then they start to become competitive. And this is exactly the kind of thing that Musk and Hawking had in mind in terms of a danger. And then the fifth law simply says that AIs should be subject to human override. Basically, you can unplug them or turn them off. Say you're building an AI and you think, maybe this thing should be in charge of its own power supply. The answer is no, it shouldn't be in charge of its own power supply, because you need to be able to unplug the thing if it's not working the way that you want it to. And then finally, there's the matter of competence. So just like you wouldn't allow a person to fly a plane if they weren't trained to have the proper licenses and so forth, you wouldn't want AI to do something that it wasn't really good at. And so with these six laws, you're making AI as safe as it can be. There's nothing in technology is perfectly safe. And then that brings up the last issue, which is, what if people don't follow the six laws of safe AI? What then? Well, certainly that's going to happen, either by intent or by negligence. And so for that purpose, you need to have defensive AI, because AI will become so advanced, we won't be able to counter it ourselves. We need a type of safe AI which counters unsafe AI. So in the future, there's going to be three types of AI. You're going to have safe AI, dangerous AI, and defensive AI.
You are listening to the Aldis Podcast. When you're looking to scale your team, or if you are interested in showcasing your company in a future episode, reach out today. Or if you're in the market for a new role, visit our website to view open positions, www.aldis.com.
I want to spend the final part of the conversation talking about the people side of AI and data, because again, from our conversations prior, you've got some interesting insight into the space. Starting with the data teams, you've had an interesting career, and your journey has gone from analyst to architect, to leader, to then chief data officer overseeing teams and functions. When you look at your prior experience, taking into account the various sectors you've worked in, as we talk today in early 2024, the evolution of a data team has changed quite dramatically over the past 5 to 6 years. In its current iteration, Mark, what do you think are some of the fundamental core building blocks to a good data team in an organization, to ensure that data management is structured to be successful? What type of positions are key? And speaking to an audience of data professionals, we've talked on the evolution of AI. What are the roles that will be more robust and stable with the evolution of AI?
When you're building your team and your programs, a couple of things that you need to consider. First off, one is, what sort of roles are you going to fill? And secondly, how are you going to organize those? You'll need data scientists, you'll need programmers, you'll need system designers, you'll need a chief data officer. I would say the area that needs the most attention here in terms of clarification is the data scientist role. What exactly is a data scientist? A lot of the confusion in that area revolves around the data scientist versus the analyst. In some cases, the term is used just as a new and improved version of analyst. Maybe you have a highly skilled analyst that knows Python, so you're going to call that person a data scientist. But just as I was referring to earlier, you have a whole lot of things that go on upstream of analysis, and that's really where your data scientist is focused. He should also be able to do analytics and know all about analytics, and preferably have experience as an analyst directly. But it's those other things upstream, the data discovery, the data understanding, database design, data systems design, metadata management, all of those things. Because if you only have the analysts, and analysts are super important, but if you only have that, then you don't really have a data management program. So that's one thing to keep in mind. And then there's the matter of hiring. How do you know who to hire? You could fill those roles, but you have to have the right people in those roles. The biggest mistake I see there is that when hiring data staff, an organization will put the most emphasis on particular subject matter. So say it's a healthcare organization, right up front at the top, they're going to put a requirement the person has experience with healthcare or finance if it's a bank. But they'd be very surprised to learn how unimportant their subject matter really is. And it's a matter of ego that's hard to put that aside. But really, all data is the same when it comes right down to it. And if you hire somebody from a larger pool of candidates and you don't emphasize the specific subject matter so much and you look for real data talent and data aptitude, then you're going to find better people. A lot of times you'll bring in somebody with a fresh pair of eyeballs that doesn't know your subject matter at all, and they're going to start performing really well. So I would encourage people to really open that aperture and then know how to hire people who have the aptitude. And the aptitude is going to be analytical aptitude. So person has high SAT scores in math, if they have a background in mathematics, engineering, physical sciences, software, any of those sorts of things, then they have the potential. And then how do you realize the potential? We have to train them. And you should train them in next generation data management.
Mark, final question from me. I wanted very much to finish on the topic of opportunity within AI data that's supporting the government, federal, public sector. As somebody who's held very senior positions, both directly with the government, but now in an organization supporting both sectors, we at Aldis here, we see shortages of talent across all industries, but none more so than within the public sector and federal government. It really is a niche within a niche. And while data science and AI has become a very popular profession over the last few years, there's a lot of people trying to obtain work in the private sector. As somebody who has unique knowledge of what's going on in the public sector forum, whether it be federal space, could you speak to the opportunity that's available within this field and how it's only going to continue just given the shortage of talent and the increased demand, and why some people who are listening to this who are maybe struggling to land in an organization, have had a turbulent time in startups, why they may want to consider the opportunities in the public sector and what's possible?
Yeah, as you hinted at there, the possibilities are huge right now. There's a lot of opportunity. And part of that is supply and demand. So I don't see that it's going to be changing, really. There's going to be ever-increasing demand. And that's because the supply is limited. So you need three different things to be outstanding as a data manager, data scientist. You have to have the aptitude, you have to have certain experience in areas like being an analyst, and then you need to know the best practices. As far as that first one, the aptitude, this is where we can't really do anything to increase the pool size. But if you're one of those people who has that aptitude, and people that go into technology and the physical sciences, that's only about 4% of the population, and that's just not going to change. Okay. But if you're one of those 4%, then I would suggest you focus on getting experience as an analyst. And by there's different types of analysts, but what I mean by that is a person who goes into databases, knows how they're structured, will quickly start to know how to build them, because as you work with existing databases, you're going to be making your own. And learning about the data systems that feed those and the people that you're serving there, because you really need to have a service mentality. You're helping the data user. That's really your objective. And then the data user is driving your organization's mission success. So I encourage people to really have that service attitude of collaboration, working with people and making the data accessible because a lot of times there's a tendency to hoard the data, to keep it to yourself or whatever, or not share it outside of your unit. So as long as people are authorized to see that data, you want to have as many of those people supplied with the data as possible. And then lastly, you need to know what the best practices are. There are some practices out there. You'll see, for instance, in a lot of data strategy documents, you'll see things like the data lifecycle and so forth. That's really not something that is going on in practice, nor is it something that should be. So if you want to be a star in this area, you're going to have to know what works and what doesn't in terms of driving your organization's mission success. But you can have a huge impact on an organization because organizations are more and more data-driven than they ever were.
Mark, thank you so much for coming on today and talking to us. Really appreciate your time and you sharing your story, your journey, and giving us some insight into your take on the current landscape of the AI and data space, with a particular focus on safety and also the opportunities for people. We wish you, your team, and everyone KBR the best of luck in the months and years to come on the exciting projects that you're involved in. And we very much look forward to having you back on the show again in the near future. So thank you so much.
All right. It's been my pleasure to join you, JP.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Aldis Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and any Android podcast of choice. You can also head over to our website, www.aldis.com, to listen to more podcasts, view our open roles, and stay up to date with industry news. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for more great episodes coming very soon.